What's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Shadow Talk, Digital Shadows Threat Intelligence Podcast. Today, I am joined by Charles and Rick, CISO of Digital Shadows. And we also have a special guest joining us today, Brian Rozek from Optiv. How are you, Brian?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. We're excited to have you. So every single time we do one of these guest podcasts, we always like to kind of get an idea of what your backstory, what your origin story is, and how you got to where you are right now. So rather than me kind of doing my research and taking the pieces and telling the audience, I would absolutely love for you to tell us how you got to where you are.
Sure, happy to. So I got started into this wonderful world of cybersecurity way back in 2000. So that kind of gives you a little sense of just how old I am. I started out as a Unix sysadmin, and one day I found a program called Crack running on our compute farm. So I thought, well, that can't be good. So I reported it to the cybersecurity team at the time, and they said, yeah, that's bad, but we don't have a lot of expertise in Unix on our team. And I thought, well, that's okay, I'll help. So I helped during the investigation, and that was a blast. I really enjoyed that. And then next thing I know, 6 weeks later, I'm rotating from IT into cybersecurity as a forensics investigator. And I did that for a few years and just sort of worked my way up into the CISO role. And I was the CISO at Texas Instruments for about 13 years. So I killed the whole curve of, you know, 18 to 36 months.
Yeah, you did well with that.
Yeah.
Right. So I feel good about that. And then I decided to try the consulting opportunity. So I joined Optiv, 5 years as of August.
Nice. That's
so I started doing some, so I started doing some consulting and then found myself rotating back into the CISO role for Optiv. So I'm really having a good time working at Optiv. I really have three parts to my job now. So I got all the usual CISO stuff. But I also get to do some consulting with our strategic clients. And then marketing. I get to do, you know, podcasts like this, write articles. I don't know, you remember, Rick, I'm sure you get this at Digital Shadows, where clients always want to talk to the CISO to understand, how do you do it? And do you use your own products and services?
Have you heard my joke on that here? Instead of saying, eat your own dog food, we talk about eat your own barbecue. And I've actually done a blog series on how we use our own tooling and operationalize it. And yeah, we've had Charles offered up with customers to talk about how we do security operations with Searchlight on the product side. So yeah, that's definitely part of the role.
Yeah, that's just sends up some red flags if clients start asking, oh yeah, we don't use our own stuff. So that wouldn't be good at all. But the other thing I like about it is I feel like I'm protecting a lot of companies instead of just one in this role. So it's been very rewarding.
That's fair. I can definitely imagine how rewarding it is. And you know, you mentioned that you were a Unix admin before you even hopped into cybersecurity. And I think that's really cool. And in my past life, I was actually a recruiter that focused in the cybersecurity space. And there were so many people that I came across that were actually like Linux admins or Windows admins that were looking to get into cybersecurity. And just understanding how that pivot point and how important it is to know the innards of a system or an operating system more specifically before you go over to cybersecurity, it's invaluable. So that's really, really cool.
Definitely helps your credibility.
For sure.
You know, dealing with sysadmins and everything.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, since you and Rick are both CISOs, you're definitely security leaders in the space. So I think something that would be definitely more advantageous for this specific episode would be to kind of cover what is on your plates for 2021 planning. I mean, we've had a really crazy year with COVID, socio-political issues, the US presidential elections. So there's so many, you know, spaces and so many risks that we're surrounded with on top of the ever-growing ransomware environment. So do you guys have any really insights into what's at the top of your list coming in 2021?
As you dig into it, in Q1, which seems like a decade ago, what you were thinking for next year versus now that we're in Q4 and what you're thinking for next year. Has that changed that much in the past three quarters?
It has. So one area that we're getting more involved in and actually accelerating is the whole zero trust concept. So I'm sure you're familiar with that from our conversations with Mr. Kindervon. But with all the remote access and our continued adoption of cloud solutions, really understanding and being more systematic about our zero trust roadmap. So we've been adopting things in pieces and parts, and now we're being much more systematic, putting together a roadmap, looking at it not only from an identity standpoint, but also from a network and endpoint standpoint. So we're kind of looking at it from those three vectors. And our first step really is just to take advantage of what do we have already with our tool set. Start turning on some features and functionality that in the past, maybe just been in monitor mode, or we haven't quite leveraged yet. So I see us doing more of that and more data flow mapping. Data flows have gotten much more complicated with AWS and Azure and Jitterbit and all these other fun SaaS applications that we're leveraging and cloud solutions. So we need to go refresh a lot of our data maps as well.
You remind me of one of the few good taglines I had at Forrester with expense and depth. My joke was that people always buy more stuff without maximizing the things that they've already invested in. So going back and, we already have this feature, we're not fully using it, is always a good step. Actually, that whole idea came from my time at Acuvant, now Optiv, obviously, but we used to have a consulting offering that we called a technology optimization program, something along those lines, mm-hmm. 8-9 years ago. And it really was to go in and look at the stack and say, oh, you're not using this. Oh, you've got overlap here. Because I think a lot of technology is not fully utilized. If you want to date yourself, you're making the joke about your age. My joke about the age would be, if you want to date yourself, you can talk about blinking lights and data centers. It's just this rack with blinking lights that we're not taking advantage of. Now it's changed. It's now blinking lights in somebody else's data center largely. But, first step for me in the 2021 planning is going back and looking at what do we have? Did it work well for us? Are we maximizing it? Are we actually enabled for it? One of the things, I'm having this conversation with the team right now, we do it every year, but we like to add 10% on to every single budget quote that we get to cover any kind of training that we might want to have. Because if you're spending, everyone's security budgets are going to be different, right? What's material to one org may not be material to another, but I like to try to budget in 10% of the cost of something that I'm using for training. Because what good is it to have the blinking lights that you bring in that no one knows how to use, that you're not taking advantage of? So I think the enablement and how are you going to enable your teams should be one of the top things that we look at for 2021 is training. Maybe you spend more money on training and less on new technology.
Yeah, we, in addition to training, we also like to budget for things like, we call them health checks. So get the partner to come in. Hey, we've been using you for 2-3 years. What new things have you added that we kind of ignored in the release notes, but we really should start taking advantage of? And are our systems and installations still optimized, after being run and maintained for 2-3 years?
I think, actually, I picked this up from my time at Acuvant as well. Back then it was on the ArcSight and things along those lines. You deploy ArcSight and then 2 years later, it's sprawling, you're not taking advantage of it. So I think that's a great point. Like, come in, how's the technology change? And then having time dedicated to focus on it. Because I think for the security practitioners and leaders in the audience, like sometimes you need to pay for a ProServe engagement to come in to give you the focus on an area with the person that knows the solution quite well to help you maximize it. Plug for Digital Shadows, actually, right? We're standing up, or I'd say we're formalizing, some of our professional services offerings. And we actually will do the same thing for Searchlight, where we can come in and do an optimization for you and make sure that you're taking advantage of all the new things that have come out, and especially if you look at, for us this year, stuff with credentials that's come out and been updated. There's a whole lot of new stuff that we're doing with GitHub and GitLab and access access keys. And those are the kind of stuff you want to maximize. Otherwise, it's the blinking lights that you're not taking advantage of.
Yeah, and I don't know what your employee base is like, but you know, we have a fair amount of turnover and people coming in and out of the organization and rotating to different positions. So, I have people now supporting technologies, that got handed off from somebody else. And that's always a rough process. So again, having them opportunity to learn from the partner directly is definitely key.
Yeah, we're at that point now. Well, Charles, when you came on board, there's stuff that you inherited that we made those decisions before you had even joined the security team.
Yep.
All right, cool. So beyond, chatting about what we have at our disposal and kind of how we want to leverage those certain tools in the coming year, I also kind of wanted to chat about threat modeling and tabletop exercises and the whole perfect practice makes perfect, especially whenever it really counts. So what are y'all's plans whenever it comes to, this increasing ransomware threat? And then also we have DDoS coupled with extortion coming in from stage left. I mean, how are y'all planning on, working with your respective security teams and employees to make sure that you're in the best possible position if that risk or that threat emerges?
So we like to start with a framework. So we're real fans of the NIST cybersecurity framework. So every year we do sort of that maturity assessment against the different controls and see where we're at. Are we getting better or worse in any areas? Do we have any major gaps? And that sort of feeds into our 2021 planning. I've seen many instances in my 5 years of consulting where companies will start out really strong in whether it's patching or whether it's identity access management. And then a new project, pops up and all their smart engineers start working on that new project. And before you know it, what was level three, level four now, declined. And so I've been a big proponent of staying focused on those foundational elements and making sure that those don't get lost in the shuffle. So that maturity assessment score is great. And I leverage third parties that come in and help me every 3 years. So I'll kind of do it myself in between years and then get that nice independent third party view every 3 years. But from a threat modeling standpoint, that is something we should do more of. That's something I have on my 2021 priority list of getting better at that. Right now we use the cyber kill chain methodology. So we map our controls to that. As well as during a post-incident review, we'll leverage the kill chain to kind of map that attack and see where we detected it and where we fell short. But that's about the extent of what we're doing from a threat modeling. You doing anything else, Rick, or anything additional than that?
I would say we have opportunities to expand our threat modeling as well. We do a good job with, and Charles is a key component of these efforts, every quarter we do a purple team exercise where we'll take a particular threat. There's one that stands out to me from last year. We did the initial access component for MITRE ATT&CK and looked at all the different ways that someone would try to gain initial access and then came up with after action review and looked at controls. One of the things I liked about that was, just turning on, we had already had it on, but one of the features to PDF all of the attachments that come in, defang them, turn them into a PDF. Turned out to be one of our most effective controls. Charles, were you on the team when we did that one, or was that one that we did right before you joined?
I think that was the one that I had just joined. So I just I came into the office early and jumped on Slack and did some screen sharing with Rob and Simon and watched them do some work. But it was I hadn't actually really started on the team yet. So
That was a good one for us because it it validated controls. Talk about, expense and depth. We saw that control in our email, in our email service was a very strong one for us. Another control that we found that was useful too, just from user population, was just adding the tag external on.
Yep.
Didn't cost a thing other than the annual subscription, you know, for the email service. But that was just one nice way to try to flag things. Obviously, it's not going to stop sophisticated attack, and people could get used to it. But it was a nice control there. One thing I like about MITRE ATT&CK, and we talked about this actually in February, March timeframe, when the Soleimani assassination occurred. And we could take MITRE ATT&CK, and if you were worried about Iranian threat actors, you could look at the MITRE ATT&CK framework for APT-33, APT-34, and you could actually take their techniques, you know, account takeover, phishing, you know, shocking, that breaking news, same types of stuff all the threat actors do. But of course, the techniques had a little bit more detail. And then if Iran was in your threat model, right, if you were a company in the energy sector, or if you had ties to, you know, research, national defense, or things like that, you know, what I wrote at the time back then was, you know, not everyone has Iran in their threat model. Perhaps it's lower in the threat model because it's more of like the opportunistic, or you just were a victim of a casting a wide net type of thing. But I think most people, you know, nation state is probably should be on the threat model, but probably a lot lower than a cyber criminal actor, as an example, or perhaps an insider, or maybe even accidental insiders, right? Just people making mistakes. So I think MITRE ATT&CK can be quite useful for doing threat models, but knowing the types of adversaries that target your sector, your peers, and then trying to put a likelihood to that, and then, you know, ranking against the other actors that might target you is a good thing to do. You don't have to do all of the Stride and all the different super detailed threat modeling. We should actually do a separate segment maybe on how to get started with threat modeling or something like that. I bet our listeners would like that.
Yeah, I think that'd be sweet.
Yeah, I think that'd be really interesting.
Cool.
Yeah, it's definitely helpful. We're trying to get a little more systematic, as well as go a little deeper than just, you know, sort of a paper review or a tabletop exercise. So we have plans next year to really start leveraging our lab environment. So actually, you know, detonate a few ransomware packages and see how, you know, our endpoint security stack, you know, holds up, and what are the actual alerts that we're going to get, et cetera. We're pretty good on the back end in terms of like testing backups and making sure that those are good and we're able to restore them. But I want to try to do a little more proactive stuff on the front end.
Yeah, it's always best for you to find it out than for your adversary to find it out for you. It changes things quite a bit when you're in that mode.
Well, and a lot of the tabletops, you know, tend to go this way. Yeah, yeah, that should stop that. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that won't get through. So it's like, well, let's actually try it and see. And then either we're pleasantly surprised or we're not. So.
Yeah, that sounds like wishful thinking to me.
I like your second approach there. It's near and dear to my heart. Just let's give this a shot and see what happens. So,
what's the worst that can happen?
It is one thing that I think we do a good job here at Digital Shadows. You know, we're a small team, but Charles and Rob, two individuals, you know, quite technical. Where when we did about a year ago, I've talked about on the podcast before, we did our extortion tabletop exercise, but we had it as a two-parter. We had the kind of executive level and the seniors component where we're talking about broader business strategy and stuff like that. But then we had the very technical response and validation and that sort of component. So we ran them not in parallel at the same time, but over the same couple days. And then we got good findings, both on the overall people and process side, but then also on the control side. What do we need to do? That sort of thing. So yeah, I think tabletops definitely need the more granular approach. Although it can be useful if you've never done one, you start one off and just have the conversation, and that can form a more detailed exercise, you know, the next month, the next quarter.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, totally agree. Well, and I definitely think that it, you know, will help incident responders become more familiar with all the processes and who to contact and what to do in the event of an intrusion or a ransomware attack or something like that. So the more familiar that they are with that process, hopefully the better your company would end up on the other end following an attack. So, yeah. Well, on that note, Rick, you were just saying how Charles and Rob are very technical individuals. And I think it's important to kind of hit on some of the recruiting plans for 2021. I mean, we have these budgets. We have a little bit more money and space for backfills or new hires, et cetera. So I was curious, what is kind of on your priority list whenever it comes to recruiting in this next year?
Brian, you want to take the first stab as our guest?
Sure. So we're looking at growing our GRC area. What we're finding is, you know, there's all kinds of fun little, you know, people respect what you inspect and, you know, all those kind of fun sayings. So what we're finding out is, you know, by providing more compliance oversight and doing more metrics, doing more assessments, we're able to keep things at a higher level of compliance and security. So we want to grow that area. We also want to go about it from a diversity standpoint. You know, we're really being much more proactive and conscious about, you know, bringing in diverse candidates. One of the things that, in fact, this is like hot off the presses last week, but Optiv recently announced a $40,000 four-year scholarship fund. And we're going to award that to an individual who, you know, identifies as Black or African American, and is studying, you know, one of the STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics subjects, again, to really try to drive that diversity in the cyber and information security field. So, you know, we're as a company starting to put money and focus efforts to increase that level of diversity. And we're going to see real big benefit out of that. I remember working at TI, you know, they're a global company. So I'm used to having a very diverse workforce and benefited from it greatly. And so I can't wait to see us continue that here at Optiv.
That is cool. I definitely will say the global workforce, actually I was just talking about that this week on some Veterans Day stuff, talking about diversity in the military, but global companies, yep, and the workforce that you have, different cultures, different ethnicities, just different perspectives, you know, as an intelligence shop, like the groupthink is one of the worst things that you can have. We had, for those that may not have listened to it, but we had Marcus Carey on and released that one maybe a month ago, something along those lines. But one of the things we talked to Marcus about was diversity in technology, and an article that he did on maybe VentureBeat. I can't remember who it was, but his suggestions on recruiting. And I think about, we mentioned it then, like historical Black colleges, and you're in DFW like all of us. And we've got options locally here, options down in Austin as well. So I think that really is a key component.
It is. We're also looking at more entry-level positions. You know, we have a bad habit of wanting candidates that have, you know, all these certifications and 10 years of experience. And what we're finding out is, you know, we can teach people the cybersecurity, but we need people to come in with that curiosity, with that drive, with those communication skills. And we're willing to give them time to grow in their cybersecurity knowledge. And, you know, someplace like a GRC, and even in some cases like a SOC, you know, shadowing other people. That's where I think a lot of this orchestration and automation is going to come in helpful. Because again, some of the entry-level people can learn from expertise and flows that we already have set in place. So it's a different approach for us going into 2021 and beyond.
Well, I think it's hard to find unicorn candidates anyway, and people that are looking for unicorns are going to drive a higher price. And there's not that many of them out there. I actually think Casey and Charles are really good examples of people that switch careers and have been extremely successful here at Digital Shadows. And, you know, just kind of shows that, you know, you can grow into it. If you have the foundation to grow and the willingness to learn I think eagerness is probably a really important thing as well. When we do our hiring, we always give exercises out, and we can tell in fact, some of our recent hiring, like the eagerness and the tenacity of candidates, goes a really, really long way, and you can tell they're so excited and passionate about something that they are going to attack it and learn it And then it goes back to enablement, right? We as security leaders, yep, we need to enable the teams to grow. So I think that's really, really important. I also think one of the interesting things too, training, right? You want to send people training. In the past, mm-hmm, we've sent people to SANS courses. Well, Casey did a SANS course, 18 months ago? I can't remember. Maybe it was last year even.
I think it was last February.
It seems like forever ago.
It really does. But
the one thing that I'm kind of struggling with a little bit in the 2021 planning on the training aspect is, you know, you're not doing the on-prem training. And I think one of the advantages of the on-prem is you could go to a course, whoever the provider was, and you're disconnected from your job and you can focus on that. I think, and now when we've actually had some staff go to virtual SANS courses, and the staff colleagues do try to disconnect, but it's almost like you're still remote working in some ways. So I'm wondering how pandemic training, you know, I don't know if you have any ideas on like, how can you maximize pandemic training when you're not in the course, when you're not next to people, building your network, hearing about people that have similar struggles and how they've tried to solve things, you know, some of the really nice things that you get from an in-person course.
Yeah, we've had to be more formal and systematic about training when it's internal like that. And what I mean by that is we're setting very specific goals and actually putting some metrics in place. So there's something around cross training. So if I need to get a second person cross trained on, you know, digital shadows, don't just say, yeah, go learn about it. But we'll actually set specific goals of, you know, I want you to learn these two or three feature sets. And oh, by the way, you're going to present that at the next team meeting. And I want you to be able to speak to or give me a demo of the product. We also set aside dedicated times. So 4 hours a week, you know, every Wednesday afternoon or every Friday morning, you know, you're off limits and you're going to do that training. You're going to write run books. So we're starting to develop more run books so that, again, you have to sit down and take the training and really understand it if you're going to actually document, you know, what you're doing and how you do it. And also wrapping that up into their performance review. So again, part of their performance review at the end of 2021 will be, you know, we set a goal of cross training on three different technologies, you know, and then tracking progress towards that. That's the only way to do it. Otherwise, you just constantly get sucked back into, you know, the email and everything else. And then your best intentions just go away.
Charles, what are you thinking for training? I know you're very much a self-starter, but any thoughts you have as we take our approach for training next year?
Some of the stuff that's been interesting to me has been some of the AWS security engineering stuff. Like they have some free courses out there for some of that. I've been looking at some of the other paid stuff. Of course, to be a good defender, I think you need to have a little bit of knowledge of offense. So some of those like the offensive security proving grounds, some of that stuff looks pretty cool. Been looking into that kind of stuff. And I think for me, mostly like right now, I'm looking more into cloud security and kind of like DevSecOps automation, like stuff like that is the stuff that's really piquing my interest that I'm looking for training on. So,
good thing it aligns for the types of skills that we need for the team in 20. Although, not ironically, this my recruiting needs and the skills that we would look for haven't really changed from the beginning of 2020 to the beginning of 2021. I still want people that, you know, we need to improve our DevSecOps capabilities. We need to continue to understand the threat actors and the tools and things that they're using. For me personally, I don't think for our org, we've seen a need to level up on a certain type of skill set post-pandemic. We were already working on zero trust and how do you enable the stack around that pre-pandemic. So we haven't seen our, I guess, training needs change too much since the pandemic started here at Digital Shadows.
Yeah.
How do you know if the training's been effective?
Sorry, go ahead.
How do you know if the training's been effective? We do the similar types of stuff when you go to a training course, present it back and try to share it, especially on like a SANS course, where if you're going to send a single person to a SANS course that costs $7,000, $8,000, right, you're going to have to bring that back. I think there's probably opportunities though to be more effective? You know, I would think implementation, like how well have we implemented something? Now I'm speaking hypotheticals, we're not doing this yet. How well have we implemented something? What's the completeness of it? How has detections changed over time as a result? You know, if you're doing some kind of attacker training and then you can bring that in, what's improved on the red side or what's improved in the blue side as a result of the training? I actually think it's a really good question because a lot of organizations struggle to get the training. If you're going to go to your CFO and say, I want to get 5 people in a SANS course that costs 7-8 grand, you know, that's a tough sell. We've been pretty fortunate with our training options here, but being able to capture, here's the benefit. We played it back to the other members of the team. It wasn't just one person. It was leveling up the group. Those, I think, are really important things if you're going to try to put something into your budget now. And when you get CFO scrutiny here in the next month or so, to be able to say, this is why we think it's going to be valuable. And it's going to help us. We spent 6 figures on this tool, right? We're wasting our money if we're not going to get it fully implemented.
Yeah. Now, do you also require, like for the SANS, do you require the certification after it?
I like to include that in the price for everyone so that they can take it. I've done it myself. Last SANS course I took, I went ahead and got the certification for it. I like to do that because I also think it's a nice retention. It's another retention angle for the staff members as well, right? Oh, I can get this certification. And I think getting a SANS cert is a meaningful cert for people in their career development. So yeah, I like to do that. Did you get your cert, Casey, on the one you did?
Yeah, so I ended up going after the certification. I don't think it was in the original plan, but after I went through a 6-day course, it was like, all this information is great, but I really want to come with something to show for it as well. So yeah, I did end up getting the cert attached to that.
Yeah, I think that's good because you're right, Rick, from a retention standpoint, that's good, right? It shows a commitment to, skill building to the staff. I've also used it in my board of directors updates. You know, one of the things that I've highlighted when I update the board is, you know, how we're growing the skill set and expertise of our security team. And one of the way to do that is through, you know, certifications. I like to be able to say things like, hey, 70% of our staff is certified in one or more security, technical or even non-technical areas. And I think that gives our board of directors some confidence that, hey, our team is strong and they're competent. And it's also a built-in excuse to continue training because you just paid all this money for me to get the certification. I need to continue education training so that I can maintain that. So I've found those to be very effective and very beneficial.
Now, do you require certifications? Well, I think one of the things we haven't really touched on, and maybe it's a good one for the last bit, is, you know, you're a professor at the University of Dallas here in Dallas. You can tell I have a degree. And I've had the opportunity over the years to guest lecture in your course. But one of the things I know we talked about when we were planning, right, was, you know, certifications, are they required when you're recruiting? Degrees, are they required when recruiting? What is your... What's your kind of thought, Professor Brian?
So I certainly think that nothing beats a college degree. No, not being self-serving here, but I definitely want to have candidates with a degree. From a certification standpoint, I don't require that when you hire in, but I put that as part of your development plan to achieve one. Now, which certification you like to achieve, I kind of leave that up to you to provide feedback on, because I want you to be invested in that decision. So I'm not going to dictate all the different certs. But I want somebody who's committed to continuing education. I think that's a very useful and required skill set of cybersecurity professionals. This industry changes so radically year to year that if you don't have a continuing education mindset, you're not going to succeed in this profession for very long.
You're going to get left behind.
Absolutely.
Now on the college degree, like for me, I was on a 12-year program because I got out of the military and then I took one class maybe every other semester up until I got sick of it. And then I went to UT Dallas, worked there full-time for 2 years, 15 hours a semester, finally got my bachelor's degree. And I found I had a couple, Forrester was one where I needed the degree for. So it was helpful mm-hmm. to have that there. But for you, when you're recruiting, is a degree a must have or a nice to have?
For me, it's a must have. And it's not just the fact that you have the degree, whether it be in computer science or engineering. But I know in teaching, you know, last semester, I was teaching, cyber law. And yes, people can memorize the different laws and the different components of regulations. But where a lot of the education takes place is, how do you then articulate that to somebody who doesn't have a law degree? How do you turn that into a cybersecurity strategy or an initiative? How do you debate and how do you make your point? And all that type of interaction and those types of writing assignments, you know, are all part of the degree process. And so I think there's a lot of value in that, because the candidate that I hire doesn't just have a bunch of technical knowledge, but they also understand how to articulate that, how to make the case, consider the budget implications and all the other aspects and facets of what goes into being a well-rounded professional.
I'm in the, it's a nice to have camp. For me, Charles is actually a good example. And Charles knows what I'm about to say, but you know, he 10 years in healthcare, doing real incident response is the joke that I always make when we, especially when we present at B-Sides DFW, but Charles doesn't have a background, or Charles, right? You don't have a bachelor's degree. You're all self-study, right?
No degree, no certifications. I took a few classes here and there, before I got on at Digital Shadows, but I was just kind of ready to get out of being a paramedic and move on to security, which was much more interesting to me. Self-studied, basically till I got to the point where I was able to get a job. But I'm currently working towards my degree. If everything goes according to plan, I just registered for my last three classes at UNT, so I'll graduate in May.
Oh, that's awesome!
Nice, man.
I'll have you beat, Rick. It'll be the 15-year plan for me from the time I graduated high school to the time that I actually graduate with a bachelor's degree. Certifications are coming. I definitely agree with you, Brian. Though I feel like there's something to be said, I would say, for most people, college teaches you how to be able to read, write, articulate, you know, become a more well-rounded person. And I think for almost any job, not just security, not just EMS, not really anything, like being able to take the thing that you are a subject matter expert in and explain it to people who are not is important. And you're probably going to be able to do that better if you've had some kind of formal education versus not. So
I'm very fond of candidates that have taken between 10 and 15 years to get their degrees, because that shows the tenacity that Charles and myself have to actually accomplish a mission.
They never give up. I like it.
You know,
now, there's exceptions to every rule, right? But I think I've always asked people, you know, would you take your sick kid to a pediatrician who doesn't have a degree? And they're like, what? You know, there are bad doctors or bad schools, et cetera. But there's something to be said for that in the end.
My joke on that's like, what do you call a doctor that was a C student? Doctor.
Doctor. But I could see that playing out. You know, you go to your pediatrician and where'd you get your medical degree? Oh, I just self-studied, watched a few YouTube videos, did some experiments in my garage. I'm good. Don't worry, you can trust me. So
I will say, I know our professions a little. That is not a doctor my kids would be at.
No, and like I said, I think there's something to be said for that. And I think there's when you look at for my other education experience, being a paramedic, so paramedic school was like basically kind of a associate's degree kind of thing. But some places you could just pay to take like a 6-month certification and then go take like the National Registry Paramedic test. And then some places made you take anatomy and physiology and, you know, pharmacology. And it was like a 2-year program to get through there and learn everything and then go take the National Registry test. And you could always tell, because the state of Texas does not require you to have a degree to be a paramedic. A lot of the time you could tell the people who just paid and hurried up and got through it versus people that studied and had a more intricate knowledge and like detail. And I think there's something to be said for that. Like I think slowing down and having a more formal education, I think does make a difference.
That person on my accident scene, the one that took a little bit more time to get their degree.
That's right. You know, I don't know if I sent you a report last week, the ISC Squared Cybersecurity Perception Study. And one of the statistics that they had that I thought was really interesting is of the, 2,000-3,000 adults that they surveyed, almost 80% said that cybersecurity was never offered, never mentioned during their school curriculum. And so one of our challenges of filling all these open positions is there are very talented individuals out there that don't even know that they can have an exciting and successful career in cybersecurity because they're not being exposed to it.
What do you think the solution for that is?
I think it's what we're doing, you know, like at the University of Dallas, you know, where we're bringing in guest lecturers like yourself and, you know, trying to get the word out. I know you as well as I and others have, you know, I mean, I've spoken to the Girl Scouts. I go to career day at local high schools, just anything I can do to get the word out about what we do and why it's important and get people excited about that and get them involved.
Yeah. I'm talking to my wife right now. I have two daughters in Girl Scouts, one Girl Scout group my wife runs. And I know that Palo Alto Networks helped sponsor a cybersecurity badge, I think last year. And I want to talk to my wife about how can we, the younger kids may be a little bit too young for it, but the third graders, I think at least getting a little bit of pepper in some cyber stalking stuff and the things that they need to be aware of as they're on YouTube and all the places these young children go to. So that's something that personally I'm going to try to get involved with now that my wife is a, troop leader, scout leader. It's not scout leader, whatever it is, Girl Scout troop leader. Yep. That's what it is.
I think you could at least have 4-year olds learning how to pick locks though.
Oh, I did. I did find my third grader. I found a paper clip, you know, opened up all the way like you would use to reset a device or whatever. And I'm like, Harper, what is this? And she said, well, it's a lock pick naturally. And she was using
naturally.
It.
She I love was using that sass.
Yeah. I was like, it was a proud moment. I mean, it was like one of those where you're like, what are you trying to pick locks to? But I was also pleased about that. So I want to keep my kids, maybe they don't go down our career path, but at least aware and safe online. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just considering, you know, social media and how digitized so many societal aspects have become over time, I think at least like a baseline of knowledge and security can take someone so far just to keep themselves safe.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, on the kind of the vault, or no, sorry. So Rick, a couple of years ago, or maybe a year and a half ago, I don't know, what is the timeline? You and Charles and I went to the Security Advisor Alliance, I think is volunteering. Mm-hmm. And that was a really cool thing. And I think we just really need more of that. So this was, I think it was 4 different schools from Dallas that came out and we ran through like this, really a capture the flag, but just more along the lines of like how to use, like search for certain artifacts on Google and stuff like that. And it was really cool. And I think that it might've been a really great kind of into what cybersecurity is and, you know, see if there's an interest in it, see if they kind of want to run with it after they learn about it. So I think opportunities like that would be, at least more of them, would be absolutely fantastic.
Hopefully we can get a vaccine and get the pandemic out of the way so we can do more of that in-person education because I feel like the pandemic has hurt that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Crossing my fingers on that one.
Well, if you're interested in getting a cybersecurity degree, certainly check out the University of Dallas. Next semester, I'll be teaching the fundamentals of cybersecurity. And it's a really good program. It's an accredited program. I actually went through the program and got my degree there and then came back as a guest lecturer, like I asked Rick to do every other semester. And then a spot opened up and I started teaching. And I love doing it. I see this as my retirement job. know, someday, you know, quit the corporate world and just go teach full time. It's very rewarding. It's really cool when you go to another company and you're walking down the hall and you hear Professor Rozak. And they, well, wait a minute. So to see students placed in local corporations, it's a very rewarding experience.
Well, we have had multiple interns from the program at Digital Shadows, and we have one analyst on our Photon research team that's a graduate of the program, Ivan. So I can recommend the program as well based on the performance of the students that we've had there, but also being on campus. It's a great campus. When we're actually going back to the campus, I should say.
Yeah. I do miss going on campus, that's for sure. I'm kind of getting tired of being stuck at home.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear that. All right, cool. Well, I suppose that should go ahead and wrap us up for this episode. Thank you again, Brian, so much for joining us. Really appreciate you being on here with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Again, I love doing this. I've known Rick for many years and really enjoy working with him. And he's taught me a lot in this profession. And love to come back on another episode if you'll have me.
Yeah, absolutely. I love watching Rick getting a little sappy over there.
I'm glad this is audio only, folks.
All right, cool. Thanks so much, Rick and Charles, for joining me again. You guys have a great rest of your week, and we'll see y'all next time.
Stay safe.
Have a good one.
Sounds good.